Welcome to Byline. I'm Rick Helbert. Well, the Kentucky State Fair Board took a major step toward reopening Kentucky Kingdom yesterday with approval of a 50-year lease. Developer Ed Hart and his team of investors say they're confident the park, that's been closed since 2009, can reopen in the spring of 2014. Joining us to talk about the park's future is Ed Hart, who's now able to speak publicly about the deal after months of negotiations. Mr. Hart, welcome back to the program.
Rick, it's always a pleasure to spend time with you and your audience.
Also here is WFPL's Devin Katayama, who's been covering the story, and he'll do most of the questioning of Mr. Hart. I should note, just for the sake of disclosure, that Mr. Hart has an involvement in the establishment of the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting here at Louisville Public Media. Specifically, he's put up a challenge grant offered for the initiative. You can find more information about that at our website, louisvillepublicmedia.org. Well, let me start with you, Mr. Hart. Your team now has this 50-year lease agreement from the state that was approved yesterday by the Fair Board. What happens now?
Right. Well, now we embark upon securing the $25 million worth of bank financing, and we've already started that process. If I can, just let me sort of explain the financing for the park. My partners and myself, my partners include the Al J. Schneider Company, represented by Mary Mosley and Orson Oliver, Ed Glasscock, and Bruce Lunsford. And together we're putting in $20 million worth of equity and arranging for a $25 million bank loan. If I can for a second, here's how we envision the financing working. Six Flags got into trouble by not reinvesting in the facility. And it's very, very important in the theme park business to make sure you always bring on new rides and attractions every year. And Six Flags stopped doing that, and as a result, they lost tremendous attendance and ultimately ran into bankruptcy issues. Of course, we want to avoid that. And here's how we're going to do it. The city and the Convention and Visitors Bureau are contributing $300,000 towards that debt financing. The $25 million of debt costs us $2.2 million annually to service. So the city and the Convention and Visitors Bureau together are putting in $300,000. Our deal with the Fair Board allows us to share the parking revenue that's worth about $900,000 a year. And we've just submitted our application for tourism tax credits, which is worth about $1 million a year for 10 years. When you add up those three pieces, coincidentally, it adds up to $2.2 million, which is the amount of money on average we need to service the debt. So Kentucky Kingdom, as an operating company, doesn't have to take any money out of its cash from operations to service the debt. That allows us to continually reinvest in the facility. Rick, one thing I might add, nobody's giving us this money for free. The city expects to get a return, as they should, in additional room nights, in additional occupational taxes, in additional impacts throughout the whole community, construction trades, hospitality. The Fair Board obviously is going to make money by way of rent and its share of parking revenues, which on average will be a little over $2 million a year. And the state, for its part, for the tourism tax credit, expects to make $10, $11 million a year, and this is most important, from folks who no longer have to leave Kentucky for their theme park experience, not to mention all the people that stop coming to Kentucky Kingdom from out of state. So everybody wins. The public sector gets a return on its investment in the facility. Our $20 million is at risk first and foremost, and we think this is a great example of a solid, profitable public-private partnership.
Now, it sounds like the most of the money is going to be spent up front, at least from the investor's point of view. Talk about what the park is going to look like in the first year, and then maybe a few years down the road when this money is really going to be invested. What's it going to look like?
Devin, of the $45 million, we intend to invest approximately $35 million for the initial season. And then we have a commitment to invest the remainder over the next couple of years. That doesn't mean to say we won't invest even more than our commitment. We'll see where the business takes us. I think everybody knows I have a long history of bringing in major marquee attractions, roller coasters and the like. So I think that's a good formula to apply to the future. Once again, because we don't have any debt paid out of operating income, we really are in a position to make major investments on a yearly basis. The park will have all the rides that are currently out there up, running, looking like new, And the only ride we're going to get rid of, because it's not a ride I brought in when I operated the park. It was one that Six Flags brought in. It was a 35-year-old steel roller coaster with one loop. I believe they called it Grease Lightning. And we're going to remove that because it's too expensive to repair. And the only other ride we won't get up and running in year one is the wooden roller coaster along Crittenden Drive, but we will eventually put that in service, and we have some very big plans for that roller coaster. We will be bringing in two additional thrill rides to fill some of that void, and most importantly, and I think our season pass holders will be happy to hear this, we'll be expanding the water park dramatically, doubling its size.
Is there any concern that the park won't be at its peak right when it opens? Is that important that as soon as it opens, it's seen as the number one attraction in Kentucky? Yeah.
I think when you have a 50-year lease, we're going to have, obviously, a ramp up. And I think the park will reach its full capabilities by year three, and we'll be ramping up. Right now, we can't do all the things we wanted to do because we've run out of time. What we're doing is what time allows us to do. The park will be terrific. It'll be safe, clean, with plenty of attractions to keep everybody happy, but it will be a 3-year ramp up. By the third or fourth year, we expect to be doing once again around 1 million visitors. If you recall, at its height, when I sold the park to Six Flags, the park was exceeding 1.3 million in visitation. So we're not concerned it's going to eventually reach its full potential. We just have to be very smart in how we do that, and we're very cognizant of the lead time to some of these major attractions. It takes more than the 15 months we have to get the park open by 2014.
Now, under terms of the lease, there's this 90-day period. Has the lease been signed by both parties?
I believe it's going to be dropped off to my office this afternoon for me to sign.
Okay, as soon as it's signed by both parties, there's this 90-day period where both sides could back out if either the financing doesn't come through or if you actually visit the park and realize that some of the rides just aren't manageable or the whole operation isn't manageable. How concerned are you that when you get on the grounds that things won't be in place or the funding won't be in place? I know you're still waiting on tourism tax credits to be approved by the state.
Well, first of all, even though there's a 90-day waiting period, Devin, as you suggest, for us to evaluate the condition, and it's going to take 2 or 3 months, I understand, for the tourism department to determine whether we're eligible for the tourism tax credits, I think they have to do another impact study. I think this will be the third impact study done on the park. So we have to wait for them to do another impact study, which sort of ties things up for 2 or 3 months. We, for our part, are not waiting. Beginning the week, the first week of February, I think that's February 4th, and that Monday, my management team, they'll be on the payroll. We're funding about $2 million to get things up and running right now. So we're not waiting for 90 days to start. I'll have 7 full-time managers on premises doing what they have to do to jumpstart the project. And to answer your question specifically about the condition of the facility, we'll have our 3 top technicians on the payroll out there confirming what we had already reviewed a year and a half ago to make sure there's been no substantive changes. I would be surprised if there's any major changes, but you never know until you check it out. You have to get under the hood, but I would be surprised. And of course, there are some things that wore down over the last 2 years, and some of the buildings are in worse condition, but I don't think there's anything that precludes us moving forward. But once again, we got to go under the hood and make sure that's the case.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this this lease agreement. I'm looking at the previous proposal that you proposed before the process was opened up for bids. How does it compare? What's left out of this agreement that you might have had to compromise on with the original proposal? I know in the original proposal, again, before it was opened up to bids, there was going to be 4 new rides and up to 2,000 seasonal and part-time or full-time workers. Now it seems like the rides have cut back, and maybe there might not be as many workers employed in the park. So what's not in there that you would have liked to see?
Yeah, the fundamental difference there is what you're referring to, Devin, is if we would have mobilized everything for year one, and that required like a year and a half, a 2-year lead time. Well, we have less than a year and a half now. And because of that, we had to phase in over the first 2 and 3 years as opposed to putting everything in that we intended to originally. So the amount of workers at the park are more or less the same. Its impact on the hospitality industry is backed off a little bit in year one because we don't expect to do the attendance when the park is fully built out. So again, you know, you're going to do less than 1 million people in year one, but you'll ramp up to 1 million visitors. So the impact will be, we'll get to what you're talking about. It just won't happen all at once. It'll happen over a gradual period of time. The most important thing for us, I think, is to make sure the local community is comfortable that this is a safe and secure park. They can, families can enjoy it without any problems from other guests. That's our number one consideration, to make sure if mom and dad are comfortable this is a place to visit. And I think there was some concerns when Six Flags was running the facility about that. We're going to turn that perception around, and we're going to make sure through our ambassadors, we'll have many ambassadors on site during the season, making sure that's a safe and secure place for the family.
Now, what will that look like? What's the difference between when Six Flags and you were operating the park and there was that perception that, maybe not a hostile perception, but a perception of kids being just dropped off and it being a place for them to roam? You'll have ambassadors, which essentially, I guess, mean people who go around and say, you know, stop doing this or stop doing that. How else do you market this as a place where you can go? For example, when the Cook family was in negotiations, they brought their whole idea of this family values idea, free this, free that, and bringing what made their other parks successful. What's going to be your campaign or your message?
With all due respect to the Holiday World people and the Cook family, and they run a very nice park. There's this perception that they're very reasonable and inexpensive, but their front gate price is very expensive. You may give some free drinks out, but you pay for it at the front gate. Our price will be markedly lower. Our general admission price will be markedly lower than Holiday World. Also, their discounts are not that steep. We will have very steep discounts. And also, their season pass is about $170 a year. I assure you, our season pass will be much more competitive than $170 a year. I'm not at liberty yet to divulge all our pricing, but I believe me, if anybody's familiar with our history, we will offer a great family value for the type of entertainment we're providing compared to Holiday World or Kings Island, for that matter.
The park is slated to be open in May 2014, around the same time as Kentucky Derby. Do you see that as a challenge or a possible plus for the opening?
I really think Kentucky Derby is a unique, iconic attraction all in itself. And, you know, Derby Festival is fabulous. We're coming in at the end of the month, May 24th, that Memorial Day weekend. So we're not in any way, shape, or form competing or benefiting from the Kentucky Derby. It's, you know, it's the iconic event for Louisville.
And I assume, though, leading up in the weeks, there's going to be a lot of people on hand and in that area doing a lot of work. Do you see that as a possible problem?
No, I do see that people, when they fly in to visit the Derby, all those people that come into the international airport, they finally they'll see a fresh, new theme park ready to go, rather than that dilapidated facility they've been seeing for the last several years.
Ed Hart, the developer leading the team that hopes to redevelop, reopen the Kentucky Kingdom Amusement Park in May of 2014, and WFPL's Devin Katayama, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, Rick.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heldet. Well, the second term of President Barack Obama has begun with his inauguration this week in Washington. The president delivered what some would call a forceful inaugural address as he laid out his vision for the country on the economy, social issues, national security, and the environment. The Courier-Journal's James Carroll covered the inauguration, the president's speech, and reaction to it, and joins us now from the CJ's Washington Bureau. Jim, welcome back to the program.
How are you? Happy Friday.
Same to you. Thank you. Well, some seem to be taken aback by the tone of the president's speech. It wasn't exactly an olive branch to his Republican counterparts.
Well, yeah, I think the people taken aback were obviously Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, you know, who I think said on the day after, you know, the era of liberalism is back. But I don't know what the surprise is. You know, presidents do try to articulate a broad vision for their term in inaugural addresses. Reagan did it. You know, every president has done it. And you know, this is in that tradition. I mean, Obama, I don't think anybody is shocked by the fact that Obama is a progressive Democrat, and he was articulating what he hoped to achieve and things that he hoped to protect in a second term, including programs that have broad public support, not exactly necessarily identified solely with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, things like that.
Well, back in 2008, when Mr. Obama was first taking office, Republicans, most notably Senator McConnell, said in so many words that their focus would be on making him a one-term president. Obviously, that's not happening.
That didn't work out.
That didn't quite work out. Are they signaling any willingness to work with him now, at least on some issues?
Well, there's the public consumption statements. You know, McConnell issued a conciliatory message on the day of the inauguration. The next day, not so much. If you saw some of the, if you were able to see some of the televised coverage of the inauguration, McConnell was sitting fairly close to the president on the inaugural reviewing stand, and McConnell looked like he had just buried his dog. So, you know, not too pleased. And I think that's, you know, that McConnell and Obama don't really have that much of a relationship, if any. I don't see any outward signs of that changing immediately. Obama did have all the congressional leaders to the White House on the morning of the inauguration to have coffee. We didn't get much of a readout on what was said. You know, it was a social event, but still, it would have been good to be a fly on the wall in that meeting. But I'm sure it was just pleasantries about the weather and things like that. But nevertheless, it would have been interesting to sit there and watch that. But that was a private meeting. You know, the bottom line is that you know, all the leaders in Congress are the same, you know, it's a new term for the president, but and a new Congress as well. But a lot of the same dynamics are at work now that were at work last year and the year before that.
Where were you staked out during the festivities this week?
Where was I?
Yeah.
I was in about the eighth row in front of the president as he delivered his inaugural address. I'm a presidential history nut as well as a reporter. It's a great opportunity and privilege to be able to witness history firsthand here in Washington. I think this is my seventh straight inauguration and my eighth overall. I had a 20-year break between Nixon's first and the inauguration of Bush 41.
Let me ask you about Joe Biden for a moment. I mean, some kind of see him as with all due respect, a bit of a buffoon who makes misstatements. But he's really a key player for the president behind the scenes, especially these negotiations with the Capitol Hill lawmakers.
Well, you know, people sort of forget those who make fun of Biden in some ways do so at their peril. This is a guy who has a long history in the Senate here. He's been chairman of major committees like the Senate Judiciary Committee. And yes, he is a extremely trusted advisor, very close to Obama in this administration. He's been given jobs like overseeing the economic recovery, the fiscal cliff deal, as well as earlier deals he helped negotiate with McConnell. And, of course, he's a point man on this effort to come up with some new gun safety initiatives. So he is certainly a figure to be reckoned with here in Washington. Of course, everybody's wondering what's going to happen in 2016. Some people thought that Biden's trots along the parade route on Inauguration Day were sort of a way to exhibit that he is in terrific shape, even though he's 70 years old, because obviously age would be a factor. He'd be 74 in 2016, and of course everybody's waiting to see what Hillary's going to do. So things are a little bit uncertain at this point, but he's definitely a factor to be reckoned with here in D.C.
Back to Senator McConnell for a moment. He's, of course, running for a re-election next year, and there's been a lot of speculation about who his Democratic opponent might be. but it looks like he'll have to fend off a challenge from the Tea Party wing of his own party. And joining Jim Carroll and me now to discuss it is Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston. Hi, Kenny. Welcome in.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Conversation. And I'll start with you, Kenny. Why are some in the Tea Party unhappy with McConnell? Isn't his campaign manager from the Tea Party?
Well, his campaign manager is Jesse Benton, who is a relative of U.S. Senator Rand Paul and former Congressman Ron Paul, who, you know, obviously is a Tea Party and libertarian icon. And yeah, I guess you could say that Jesse Benton ran Senator Paul's general election campaign. Senator Paul is obviously from the Tea Party, ran a lot of the presidential campaigns of Ron Paul. So I think Jesse Benton has quite a comfortable relationship with a lot of Tea Party groups. That said, here in Louisville, more than a dozen of them are kind of rejecting Benton as this great Tea Party leader who is taking up for them. And basically, they're unhappy with McConnell for a variety of reasons, but you were talking about Vice President Joe Biden. The one thing they hate the most is that McConnell keeps making deals with Vice President Biden. They didn't like McConnell's fiscal cliff deal. They haven't liked a lot of what McConnell has done in the past 30 years. And so they're kind of rejecting what they call a co-opting of their movement. And they say they're actively recruiting someone to run against McConnell and pull him even further to the right.
As far as possible Democratic opponents, Jim, of course, Ashley Judd's name is still out there. And she was at the inauguration, but she hasn't made any firm commitments as of yet, has she?
She hasn't. She sounded like she was walking a little closer to committing to a race. You know, if you try to read the tea leaves, you know, she said she was seriously considering it. She said the people of Kentucky needed a fighter, and she had 10 generations of her family that lived in the hills, and there were some fighters among them. You know, you try to interpret all that and think, well, gee whiz, maybe she is going to run. Other people are, her mother seemed to be hinting without any words, but sort of facial expressions in a recent interview with Larry King that maybe she's looking at running against Rand Paul instead. Hmm. It's hard to say. She's still thinking. And while she thinks, really, the rest of the Democratic field is frozen in place, really just kind of waiting.
Kenny, if not Ashley Judd, who's at the top of the list? Whose name?
Well, I think a lot of Democratic state office holders and strategists here in the state would love to see Secretary of State Alison Lundgren Grimes run. Of course, we've seen McConnell in some of his statements pretty much say, you know, a race against me is not your way to become governor in a few years. That's a direct shot at Secretary Grimes. But they like that she's a young woman as well, just like Ashley Judd, that she's actually run statewide before, leading vote getter in 2011 here in the state. And so that's kind of the next person they would like to see. Anyone else that they bring up has pretty much crossed their name off. A lot of state office holders have said they're not going to do it. And so after that, you're looking at maybe some well-known former party chairs or some people who hold a lower office. And, you know, whether that's a good or a bad thing, it remains to be seen. People forget Daniel Mangiardo was once a state senator when he challenged Jim Bunning and then also ran again in 2010 and almost beat Jack Conway in a primary. We're talking less than a percentage point. So a state senator could possibly get in this race. I'm not saying one will, but someone at that level. The question is, you know, Mitch McConnell obviously stronger than Jim Bunning was in those last couple elections.
And Jim, McConnell was, as he always is, well-positioned financially for another run, right?
And raising more money all the time. He's actually going to be in New York City this weekend in a Central Park condo where another fundraiser is being held. He just had one on Thursday. He has another one, I believe. He has one on Thursday here in D.C. He has another one in D.C., I think, Monday night, and in between he'll be in New York City. So he's raising money all the time.
And millions already in the bank. So some other possible names that Kenny that have said they won't run. Mayor Greg Fisher here in Louisville, has he pretty much ruled out a run?
He's ruled it out. Attorney General Jack Conway, who ran against Rand Paul in 2010, says he's not going to do it. Auditor Adam Edelin says he's not going to run. Governor Steve Beshear says he's not going to run. Lieutenant Governor Jerry Abramson says he's not going to run. The list of people who clearly
John
won't
Yarmuth
run.
Said he's not
yeah,
running.
John Yarmuth right. as well. So the list of people who clearly say they won't run against McConnell is a lot longer than the people the list who say they might. But, you know, strategists are always counting on those mites as possibly because, you know, a lot of them think that this might be Mitch McConnell's last term as a U.S. senator and when's the best time to possibly go on the attack and win a seat. And a lot of Democratic strategists say now is the time.
His last opponent was Bruce Lunsford, right? And he's showing no interest either.
No, he said a couple of years ago that he's out of politics as well. So not a long list. What it basically comes down to is will Grimes or Judd jump into the race and make this a high-profile race?
Should be interesting. Kentucky Public Radio's Kenny Colston and the Courier-Journal's Jim Carroll joining us from Washington. Thanks to both of you for being on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
This is Byline on WFPL. Louisville's Rubbertown neighborhood has been a mix of industry and residences for more than 70 years. That dichotomy has been fraught with problems as the city has tried to keep the industries while also addressing residents' concerns about chemical pollution. But what's the solution to the problem? WFPL's Erica Peterson tries to answer that question.
Ebony Cochran says there's a lot to like about her neighborhood in Louisville's West End.
You make a right and you will hit lots of green space, beautiful parkway with beautiful tall trees, with nice houses.
Cochran is a leader with a volunteer group called REACT, Rubbertown Emergency Action.
But if you make a left off of my street, you are going to run into lots of railroad tracks. And on the right, you're going to start seeing the beginnings of Rubbertown chemical plants.
And there's the but. Pretty much everyone I spoke with for this series, from Park Duval to Riverside Gardens, said they like living where they live. But the health and safety problems, past, present, and potential, seriously affect their quality of life. So, what's the answer? Do you kick out the industry, move the people, or find some middle ground where everyone can coexist? And for people who have spent their lives worried about toxic emissions from Rubbertown, is it even possible to coexist? Wilma Subra is an environmental scientist who's worked with communities dealing with pollution all over the United States, including Louisville. She says some neighborhoods have been bought out and moved away from industry. This reduces their exposure to chemicals, but introduces other problems.
It tears apart the social fabric of the community because they live together. All their social networks are in that community. And when you get a relocation program, frequently, they're not relocated to the same area.
Instead, Tom Fitzgerald of the Kentucky Resources Council says society needs to change the way we look at pollution and stop tolerating companies that expose people to potentially hazardous chemicals.
Ultimately, the solution that we should be moving towards is the substitution of less toxic chemicals, and ultimately towards waste reduction rather than utilizing the public's air and land and water resources for waste disposal.
Environmental groups have been pushing reforms to the regulations over the chemicals that are used everywhere, from factories to food packaging. The Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, is supposed to regulate toxic chemicals. But Elizabeth Crow of the Kentucky Environmental Foundation says, in reality, it falls short.
Most people, you know, living nearby a facility, or even most people of us who go shopping at the grocery store, assume that if we buy a product or if a company is using a chemical in their manufacturing process, that they wouldn't be allowed to do that if the chemical was actually not safe. And unfortunately, that's not the case.
Under TSCA, the EPA needs evidence that exposure to the chemical in the quantities it's used in is dangerous. Only then can it require product testing. Ebony Cochran of REACT says that logic is fundamentally flawed.
The burden of proof should not be on residents. So we shouldn't have to bring scientific proof that these chemicals are harming us.
Cochran and Crow support a bill in Congress called the Safe Chemicals Act. It would require the industry to prove chemicals are safe before they're allowed to enter the market. Chemical companies say they're on board with TSCA reforms. The American Chemistry Council has publicly said it's willing to work toward a bipartisan solution, but it has major problems with the proposed legislation. The industry group spent more than $7 million in lobbying last year, and some of that was against the Safe Chemicals Act. The ACC says the bill would place too much of a burden on regulators and compromise companies' trade secrets. If Louisville were being planned today, the city's founders probably wouldn't sandwich industrial and residential areas next to each other. Rubbertown was started out of necessity during World War II, and it's hard to find anyone who thinks the design is perfect. But now the city is stuck with it, and it looks like any solution is going to be imperfect as well. Erica Peterson, WFPL News.
Erica's reporting on health issues in Rubbertown was undertaken as a California Endowment Health Journalism Fellow at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Journalism. To read this and other stories in the series, go to WFPL.org and search on Rubbertown Health. You're listening to Byline on WFPL. Last month, Newark, New Jersey Mayor Cory Booker accepted a challenge to live on a $4 per day food stamp subsidy. He was the latest in a group of government officials, celebrities, and other high-profile individuals across the country to raise awareness of what it's like to stretch a food stamp dollar. This week, the Food Stamp Challenge has been conducted in Louisville, where the number of people who depend on a government subsidy to feed themselves and their families has soared in recent years. The local challenge was organized by the Jewish Community Center, and two of its participants are here. Welcome Matt Goldberg, Director of Community Relations and Development at the Center, and Jessica Goldstein. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us.
Welcome.
Now, your subsidy, Matt, and for both of you, for 1 week was $31.50. First of all, how did you arrive at that figure?
$31.50 is the national average for what a food stamp recipient receives. Some people get a little more, some people get a little less. There's a formula that's used to figure out how much you get, but $31.50 is the average, which averages out to $4.50 a day or $1.50 a meal.
So this is, Jessica, day five of the project for you?
Day five.
And how are you?
A little peckish.
A little peckish?
A little hungry, peckish. Maybe. Yeah. The first couple of days, I set my challenge to only eat healthy food. Mm-hmm. So lots of beans, lots of brown rice, vegetables, fruits as I could afford them. And what I'm finding is that I can eat healthy food, but I can't quite get enough calories. And the first couple of days are pretty easy, and by day five, I'm thinking about food all the time.
What about you, Matt?
Unfortunately, I did not go the healthy route. I went the most filling route. To have $4.50 a day to spend on food, you really have to stretch. And two of the challenges I found was looking at everything you buy from a very small thing to a very large thing as far as food goes is really a financial decision. It's no longer about taste or about mm-hmm. nutrition. It's really what can I afford? How can I stretch my dollar? So I went for things that were the most filling, spaghetti, rice, beans. I found buying any kind of real protein, like a meat or fish, was cost prohibitive. But I did the best I could. I shopped at the beginning of the week. I kept track of what I was buying. I planned out my meals as best as I could. And I can't really say that I'm hungry, but I can say I'm very bored of all the food that that I'm denying myself and what I'm eating.
So it's very easy to fill up your – to use up your subsidy. I went to the store the other night. I was thinking about this. Not about some modest things, nothing extravagant or a lot of it. And my grocery bill was like $52.
Right.
And so
right. The real challenges are buying fresh food. Mm-hmm. Fresh vegetables are expensive. Fresh fruit is very expensive except for bananas. People can really live on $31.50, but it is not a nutritious way to live. You really do not have access to healthy food. It's really the bare staples, things like spaghetti and rice and beans, things you can cook in bulk and have throughout the week. That's really a staple of the food stamp diet.
And even with rice and beans, I found that even that can be challenging because some of the things you think of that makes it taste better are expensive. Like, I think you think that things like kale is going to be expensive or that pineapple in winter is going to be expensive, but onions turn out to be expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if an onion is 67 cents, that's one-third of your dinner budget.
Wow.
I have been parceling out my onions.
So why did you do this? I'll start with you, Matt.
The whole idea behind this was really it started in the Jewish community, and we want to raise awareness for this food stamp program, which is federally known as the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And it's a federal program that feeds over 46 million people, and it's a very high number in this country. And it's a program that does not cost a lot of money, and yet it is constantly under threat of being cut or being altered or being reduced from budgets proposed by both sides of the aisle. What we're doing is we're trying to raise awareness. We're trying to raise awareness of this particular program, encourage our leaders in Washington and locally that this is a program that cannot be cut. And we understand the financial realities that are going on, but if cuts have to be made, and we know they have to be made, they should be not be made on the backs of people who really can't afford it.
And why did you get involved, Jessica?
Partly to draw attention to hunger, partly because since this is something I do have political opinions about, I thought it was important to walk a mile in someone else's shoes. And then I also took it as a personal challenge. I really wanted to see if you could eat real food on this very low budget, because you always hear that you can't. That you have to have a larger food budget to afford healthy food. And I wanted to see if that was the case.
Do you think you could do this long term if you had to?
I would be eating a lot of junk. No. Because right now, like I said, by day five, I'm really feeling that calorie deficit and I'm hungrier. And you can do that for a week. But if this were my life day in, day out, week after week, I'd be looking at the cheap processed food that had not that many vitamins and minerals and a lot of salt.
You know, the reality is this program is supposed to be supplemental. But the reality is that for most people on this program, the food stamps are their primary source of food. And to live on it for an extended period of time is very, very difficult. And it's part of raising awareness is not just for political purposes, but so that your average person can have an understanding, kind of walk a mile in the shoes of people who have this, who are down on their luck and cannot afford to buy food on their own and have to depend on a government program that provides them with the bare minimum.
I was going to say this is a primary resource for a lot of people. What other resources are available? We're lucky enough in this community to have the Dare to Care Food Bank, but I'm sure it's taxed as well.
Dare to Care Food Bank and all the our own Jewish Family and Career Services Food Bank is a affiliate of Dare to Care. Food banks in the last 4 years since the economy went south, the shelves are barer, more people are using it. The clients that are going to these food banks, they're not just people who you would imagine would be down on the luck. These are middle-class people who are having trouble making their ends meet. Locally, we do a pretty good job. We do have Dare to Care, which is a fantastic organization. We do a lot of work with Dare to Care. The Jewish community participates in the Hunger Walk every year. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And some children that are in JCPS get to go home now on the weekends with food to carry them through till Monday.
Blessings in a backpack.
Blessings in a backpack.
It's another organization that we're going to be raising money for.
Because we haven't brought this up, but a lot of children, most of their nutrition comes from school meals, unfortunately.
That's right. They don't get the nutrition at home, so they have to depend on schools to feed them.
Which are better. School meals are not what you remember, thankfully.
I don't have fond memories.
JCPS, I think, was the first in the country to adapt the new rules governing how many calories per meal. They have a fruit and a vegetable on every plate. So they're doing better.
Got about a minute left. You are ending your participation in this program, I guess, this weekend. There's going to be an event at the Jewish Community Center to talk about it.
At JFCS, there will be an event. For more information, you can contact JFCS. But as we wrap up the challenge, Jessica and I, we can go back to our regular meals, but we should all keep in mind the people that cannot go back to their regular diets and have to live on these kinds of government subsidies for an extended period of time.
Yeah, the last day before the challenge started, I threw an avocado roll into my grocery cart from the deli section, and it was $4.99. Mm. And this was going to be part of my lunch, and it was more than the budget for a whole day. I don't think I'll ever look at that the same way again.
All right. Matt Goldberg and Jessica Goldstein, participants in the Food Stamp Challenge here in Louisville. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL. Welcome back to Byline on WFPL. I'm Rick Heldet, and it is time for our arts segment, and WFPL's Aaron Keene is here. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Rick.
We're going to be talking about the Fund for the Arts in just a moment, but I know there's a couple of events this weekend I want to talk about first involving the Louisville Visual Arts Association, right?
Yes, the Louisville Visual Arts Association, I think a lot of folks know, moved from their longtime home at the Water Tower on River Road. They've moved downtown. They're in temporary offices right now, but what they have done also is open a downtown gallery space. So this is kind of exciting. It's in the Whiskey Row Lofts building right there by the Second Street Bridge, right on Main Street, kind of in the main arts corridor where you get the First Friday trolley hop path and everything. And their gallery is called Public, and it's open to the public. And their first exhibit is open now. There are 15 local artists, and each artist or artist pair created an original work on the theme of Public using a light box. So it's a light box installation. And you know, one of the cool things that I thought about the exhibit was how LVAA does a really good job of bringing together really a diverse slate of artists in one space. So in this exhibit, for example, you have artists who are kind of well known in the Louisville art community, like Bryce Hudson, exhibiting alongside some folks who are new to town. Susanna Crum and Rudy Salgado just moved here last year. And then you also have artists from the Studio Works program, which is a public art gallery and studio that works with artists with developmental disabilities. So you have it's a nice little slice of, you know, this is Louisville's art community altogether. And now it's public and open downtown.
All right. And also, I think you want to talk about the Louisville Ballet for a moment.
Yeah. So the Louisville Ballet has their annual choreographer's showcase this weekend. It's performances tonight and Saturday night. And instead of at the Brown or the Whitney Hall, every year the ballet opens up their own studio for this. So it's a little intimate. It's a little informal. But the ballet, the dancers themselves choreograph these pieces and then they perform in each other's pieces. So it's another really crucial component of how the Louisville Ballet develops, helps their artists develop their whole artistic life, not only on stage, but behind stage as well. Pretty cool program. Right.
And it's time for an all-important update on the Fund for the Arts, and our friend Barbara is here. I'll let you introduce her.
Yeah, you know, the LVAA and the Louisville Ballet are both cultural partners of the Fund for the Arts, and so it's a great time in January to visit the fund and see what's happening as we kick off the new campaign year. Welcome, Barbara Sexton-Smith, President and CEO.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
So I know that next Tuesday, we're going to have a big public kickoff program for this year's fund campaign. But let's take a second to reflect back on the last year. How did the fund do in 2012?
Well, the Fund for the Arts in 2012 generated $8.1 million, which was an 11% increase in our business in 1 year, and it made us the number one United Art Fund in America. And there are 56 cities across the country that have a United Art Fund, so we compare ourselves to places like Cincinnati, Milwaukee, Charlotte, Memphis, Oklahoma, Dayton, and so forth. So we're really happy about that. And in that 11% increase, that meant $790,000 new dollars were generated last year to then distribute to 83 different organizations. So we've also funded programs in 134 schools throughout the region.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about education in a second. I just want to know, is that 11% increase, is that economic recovery at work, or is that really a groundswell of increased support overall from the Louisville community?
That was a groundswell of increase in support from the previous year, mm-hmm. because the previous year had been a $7.35 million campaign. And so we were really excited last year when the campaign generated that much revenue. And you think, well, where in the world did that come from? 24,000 people in this area in southern Indiana contribute, and 20,000 of those folks contribute through payroll deduction. So when you think about who's really giving, it's a whole lot of people giving a little bit, most of them through payroll deduction at the company where they work.
So those are workplace campaigns, which are kicking off soon?
Actually, we run workplace campaigns all year long.
Okay.
We have had several organizations have already completed their employee campaigns and have turned in some really nice results. For example, all of the folks at Norton Healthcare and all their locations under the leadership of Steve Williams and Russ Cox and Mary Newby, they have turned in a substantial increase already. And we're very excited about that, as well as the employees at the Louisville Water Company. They ran their campaign this last fall under the leadership of Billy Meeks, head of the union there at the water company, and the president and CEO of the water company, Greg Heitzman. They've turned in a substantial increase as well. So we're hoping to let the good times flow the Louisville Water Company way. Yes, we are. We're going to stay on tap and on top. That's right. I hope everybody's drinking pure tap water out there. It's the number one best tasting water in America.
I see what you did there, Barbara. Well, if a company, especially maybe a smaller workplace, folks are listening right now and they're thinking, well, we don't have a Fund for the Arts campaign here. How would a representative of a company go about starting one?
Great question, and thanks for asking that. They just need to call us at 582-0100, and we've already had a number of organizations calling recently and asking if they can run campaigns. And so Bobby Clarkson with R.H. Clarkson Insurance Company, their employees invited me over several weeks ago, and we stood in the lobby one morning for about 15 minutes, and I talked, and Aaron, it was crazy. At the end of the talk, almost everybody in the room signed a pledge card and turned it in. So we're very happy about that. So thanks to those folks.
Well, you know, I think that the workplace campaign component of the Fund for the Arts is so interesting because the arts, the research is out there, the numbers are out there. I think people are starting to really understand that arts programming in a community isn't just, and I'll put quotes around that, just a cultural perk for leisure dollars, but that it's, you know, fills legitimate business needs as well.
Yes, it does. And arts and culture are very serious business. If you look at things on a national level, arts and culture produce, in the nonprofit world, 4.1 million jobs in America. Right here in our region, we have 8,000 jobs that are tied directly to arts and culture. And then if you look at things on a national level, there's $22 billion in tax revenue generated from those jobs. But now on a local level, we have a $259 million economic activity generated every year in our region from these arts and culture activities. So as when I'm going up and down Main Street or throughout the urban core and I see folks going into the theaters and the museums and the galleries and so forth, we know research shows that for every ticket purchased, an individual will spend an additional $24.60. So that is thriving growth in our community that we need to be grateful for.
Yeah, I think that the conversation here in the community right now that continues to sort of come up about the possibility of an NBA team here in Louisville, and one of the arguments pro for that is to help attract top talent for business here, to help attract new businesses to open offices here, because it's one of those cultural components that helps attract a talented workforce. But the arts play a huge role in that as well.
Yes, the arts play absolutely a huge role. There are 1.5 million attenders to arts events in any given year. And I think when you juxtaposition the research of numbers of folks attending sports events in our region versus professional sports events, the college events, mm-hmm. As opposed to who's attending the professional visual and performing arts events, you will see there are many more people that are attending the arts and culture in any given year. And more than 100,000 folks in any given year are coming across the bridges, and maybe soon to be more bridges.
Right.
From Southern Indiana region coming over into the downtown Louisville area to participate in the arts and culture that we offer here.
And this is also a pretty vital component of Jefferson County Public Education as well.
Yes. The Fund for the Arts and the Jefferson County Public School System have one of the most successful arts-rich partnerships in the entire country. And if you look at the contributions that the Fund for the Arts receives in the payroll deductions from the teachers and staff and administrators in the JCPS system, it is $249,000. It's the fourth largest employee campaign in the region. And the reason I think for that is they see the arts in their classrooms, they see the field trips that are all curriculum-based that the students are getting to participate in. And there's a lot of research out there that shows if you have arts-rich experiences during the school day, you drastically increase the attendance rates, the grades on test scores, and then the graduation rates.
Also, civic involvement and volunteering, volunteering for political campaigns and voting when they become of age. I mean, it has such a ripple effect outward is what the studies are showing.
Right. And there are studies from the College Board as well as the National Endowment for the Arts and as well as an extremely well-documented body of research by Dr. James Catterall, which can point directly to the fact that, for example, eighth graders who had high levels of arts engagement from their kindergarten all the way through their elementary school, they showed considerably higher test scores in science and writing than students that did not have high levels of arts engagement.
Yeah, so science is one of those things that you don't necessarily think of as being intimately connected to, say, theater or ballet or painting, but it is. It is.
Right. Another thing that I'm very interested in is the research shows us that 71% of the at-risk students that have an arts-rich experience during their school will attend some sort of college, as opposed to only 48% of those at-risk kids. So my goal is someday we'll be announcing we have 100% high school graduation rates in our community. Why not? We can achieve that because together, through the arts, we do create a great American city.
And so on Tuesday at the Brown Theater, there's a free program from noon to one, includes a boxed lunch and everything. And the community is invited out to take a look at some of these amazing programs that the Fund for the Arts helps to fund.
Right. And that boxed lunch is coming from Jefferson County Public Schools. So we thank them for that. We'll get to see what the kids are eating. And we have a great lineup, Aaron. We're going to kick off the show with our campaign video this year. But the Kentucky Opera will be performing, Louisville Ballet, Walden Theater, the Louisville Youth Choir. Actors Theater visited me this morning, and they're supposedly going to have me turn into a playwright right in front of your eyes on the stage. I'm working with Keith McGill. I'm not sure how that's going to play out.
I'll be there for that.
And then have you heard that Ben Solee
yes.
has signed on? So we're very excited about that. And then Louisville Orchestra will have four musicians on stage with us. We're so excited about that. Jack Griffin and Andrea Levine, Don Gottlieb and Michael LeBron. So we're very excited. Stage One Family Theater. And then we close the show with the Men of Motown. And these are going to be six young fellas under the coaching of Gregory Romming. And then some finales planned. And
something. I don't know. A big surprise, maybe?
I think so. They told me to wear tap shoes. I don't know what that means. So all I did was call Debbie Scopecchio at Creative Alliance because she's got tap shoes.
Oh, all right. Well, that's Tuesday at noon at the Brown Theater. Just go to funforthearts.org to RSVP.
Or that's funforthearts.com.
.com. Sorry.
All right. We are out of time. Thanks, Barbara, and congratulations. That's all the time we have for today's program. Byline is produced by the WFPL News staff, our production team led by Laura Ellis and Brad Yost. I'm Rick Howlett. Have a good weekend.